This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stasio. North Carolina has no confirmed cases of the coronavirus, and yet our airports, schools, grocery stores, and hospitals are taking precautions and asking us to do the same. What are you most concerned about as this disease may come our way? We're taking your calls and emails and tweets. You can reach us at 877-962-9862. Email sot@wnc.org, 877-962-9862. Joining me now, Jonathan Quick, goes by Jono, adjunct professor of global health at Duke University, former director of essential drugs and medicines policy at the World Health Organization. Jono, welcome to the State of Things. Good to have you here.
Thank you, Frank. Good to be here.
Describe some of North Carolina's points of entry and talk about the ways in which, you know, we might see this virus come to North Carolina.
Well, so far, most of the entries of coronavirus into the U.S. has come from travelers, and some from person-to-person contact. I mean, North Carolina is totally connected with the global economy. The universities and the Triangle Global Health Community is very active. So that's one possible source. But also, if you look at what's happening state by state, I mean, if we go back just a week, we had a dozen states. We're now 15 states, and it's getting closer. So it may well be just if it really takes hold, just somebody driving through from Florida or Georgia.
So we have a massive amount of medical research, pharmaceutical research, and I wonder if that changes the way a state responds or prepares for this kind of a thing.
Well, North Carolina has a strong health community in terms of the hospitals and delivery system. So that's a core of it, which works hand in hand with the research community. So I think we do have expertise here. We have some of the world's leading experts in coronavirus here. So we can draw on that expertise. But we also have a state that state-by-state assessment of health emergency preparedness, we have a state that's well prepared.
How so?
Well, there's an annual scoring that's done on the ability of a state to prepare, recognize outbreaks, respond to outbreaks, and we have a good system there.
Well, how do you respond? I mean, that's the sort of interesting thing. You think on the one hand, when I think about response, I think vaccine, you know, about the only thing we can do. I don't think this thing is going to burn itself out. Maybe they do. Maybe they just simply burn themselves out. That doesn't seem to be what's going on in this case. So, you know, when you say respond, what do we do as a state? What do the institutions do?
So the first thing is the preparedness. And the governor came out and set up a task force for coronavirus a week ago and is bringing together different parties. They've provided, working closely with the CDC, good advice for individuals, for communities, for the health facilities, for businesses. And we could go one by one with those. Each of those areas, it's really important to prepare ahead of time. Mm. And not wait until the crisis is here.
Let's go to the phones now. Andrea is on the line from Asheville. Hello, Andrea.
Hi, how are you?
Well, we're doing fine so far. Will you have a question for us?
Yes, I do. I was curious how is the coronavirus being treated once you get it? I know it's a virus, so I'm assuming that penicillins and things like that don't help it.
Yeah, that's a good question. What do you do?
Right.
Thanks.
Okay. So basically, thank you for the question. 80% of coronavirus infections with this coronavirus are mild and are just like a flu. So you stay home and drink liquids and wait till the whole thing's clear. If people get sick enough to get into the hospital, the biggest killer and the biggest risk is that because the virus has basically attacked and debilitated your lungs' protective defenses, the biggest thing is a bacterial pneumonia. So that is treated with antibiotics. And it's particularly hard on older people who have a slightly less active immune system, but also chronic diseases. And that's why part of this preparation is really being sure you're up to date. For example, we do have good vaccines against pneumonia, and you need to have those. Because that won't do anything for the coronavirus, but it may save you from the bacteria that comes on top of the coronavirus.
Effect, yeah. Thanks for the call, Andrea. So that leads to this question, though. The mortality rate officially is 2%, but that's only assuming we know the infection rate. And there may be far more people infected than we're reporting because they didn't know they had it, right? So that's far lower than SARS. And I'm wondering, this is a virus that's killing people, and it can cause very serious illness and send you to the hospital. On the other hand, when you look at the rates of serious illness and death over the infection rate, are we responding properly, or are we overestimating the problem here?
Well, I think as the epidemic goes on, our data get better and better. So for people that are healthy in adults and even in young people, it's maybe a 1% rate. Even that, or half of that, is 5 to 10 times what the influenza rate is. And if you look with people with heart disease, it's a 10% fatality rate. So I think the worrisome thing is indeed that it does appear to be more fatal. We can say whether it's 5 times more fatal or 10 times more fatal. It is. That's the concerning thing.
877-962-9862, the number to call if you have questions about what to do and the spread of this disease. I'm talking to John O. Quick, who's an adjunct professor of global health at Duke University, talking on the state of things about the coronavirus and what to do about it, also taking your emails. And we do have an email question from Donna, which is, should North Carolinians restrict their activities? Remember, no reported incidence of the disease. We haven't seen it here. Should we not be getting out?
No, and I think if you, I would urge everyone to take a look at the guidance that's on the state website for coronavirus, and also for your own schools and institutions, because there is a lot of information and good advice. Basically, the problem is getting larger in some parts, but the risk right now is low. So I would, let's put it this way, if you feel safe driving to the airport and you feel safe flying around in any flu season, then I wouldn't worry about coronavirus right now. You need to monitor, and as an individual, you need to do your own risk assessment. And hand washing, as simple as it seems, good hand washing makes a huge difference.
I've always been curious to know, and it's probably an impossible thing to measure, the infection rate compared to the exposure rate. I would love to know which diseases you get very easily and which are, you know, a lot of people with a pretty good immune system could be exposed to and not even be symptomatic. I don't suppose we have any way of measuring that.
Well, no. What we do know, though, in terms of how contagious things are, is that some diseases, like measles, any one infected child will infect 15 to 18 other children. Hmm. With this, it's more like a flu or other some of the other viruses where you may infect only 2 or 3. But there's actually a lot of good research on that.
How about air travel? People want to know if it's advisable at all to be on an airplane, that closed environment, people from all over the world are on the plane with you. Should you travel by plane at all?
If you're traveling in areas where there hasn't been coronavirus and all, I have not restricted my travel. Let me put it that way, and I haven't said anything. I haven't suggested that to my kids or my family. So.
All right. Well, we're taking your calls and emails right now. You can reach us at 877-962-9862. Our email address is sot@wnc.org, talking about what to do in the wake of, or in advance of, I guess, the coronavirus, not yet present in the state of North Carolina. And I want to bring one more guest into the program now. Priscilla Wald is the author of Contagious, Cultures, Carriers, and the Outbreak Narrative, also a professor of English at Duke. Priscilla, welcome to the State of Things.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Your book focuses on the public narratives that accompany these disease outbreaks. So talk about the conversation so far and how you hear it going around the coronavirus.
So I'm particularly interested in things like when you talked about the 2% mortality rate and the way that the more we learn, the more it seems to be going down. So the 2% death rate was the original rate in Wuhan. But as we're discovering, as Jana was saying, more and more people have the disease, that rate is going down. But that's the kind of figure that really alarms people when they hear 2% death rate as opposed to 0.1% for a normal influenza, people get very alarmed. So this is where I think it's very important to be informed, for the media to be very, very clear about what these things mean, and to be careful how we talk about them. The overreaction to them can often be as dangerous or in some cases more dangerous than the disease itself.
This seems like a very difficult thing. I mean, a headline today in the New York Times was 6 deaths in Seattle. Well, wow, you know, the headline, yeah. New York Times, upper left. But, you know, compared to the number of, how many flu deaths were there today in Seattle? Maybe more. And, you know, you can't put all that in a headline. So that's part of the question. Like, can we not report this? Can we not report the deaths? But another, let me just maybe ask the same question a little bit differently, which is, can we, as in the media or in public health, do the kind of calculus about how the public is going to react and say, let's not tell them that because they'll overreact? Isn't that scary,
too?
Oh,
no. No, right. I would never say don't tell them. But you gave an excellent example with the 6 people in Seattle. And my heart, of course, goes out to the victims and their families. But it's also important to know that 4 of those people were in an assisted living care, and 2 of them were people with health complications, underlying complications. The other news that's coming out of Seattle is that 80%, as I heard it this morning, of the of people seem who have tested positive didn't know they had the disease. So those are figures, and this is what I mean. I would never ask the media not to inform the public. That's the job of the media. But they can explain in more detail. And, you know, when a headline screams something, people hear that, they get alarmed, they don't stop and even listen to the story. So to take real care with how we're communicating, with giving the whole story, with, and I hate to say it, maybe slightly less sensational headlines. I realize they sell papers. I'm a big fan of newspapers. Right. But still, I think those are really important.
Jana, how did we do this as the public health professionals? You've been in this. You worked at the WHO. You know, you're professionals. You have access to a lot of data. You know a lot of stuff. And it's in context. It is nuanced. Now you have to get the word out. You can't keep it to yourselves, no matter what the public reaction might be. But you know that what you know about this is bigger than it's going to fit in a couple of columns in the New York Times. How do you manage that as a public health professional?
Well, there are a couple of key principles in crisis and health emergency communication. Be first, be right, be honest, be empathetic, and when you say what you know that's and tell people what they need to do. So you want to get the main points out there. If they're critical questions, like at first, how does it spread? You say, here's what we know now. And then as information develops, you add on to that. But I think the key thing is information that's action-oriented, that tells people what they need to know to respond to the current situation and answers the questions that are on people's minds. But typically those are, where did it come from? How dangerous is it? How does it spread? So anticipate those questions.
Let's go back to the phones now, and we will talk to, who is that on the, is it Chilla from Greensboro is on the line. Hello, Chilla.
Hi, how are you doing today?
Good.
Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
So my question is, I'm actually leaving today for Europe, traveling through London to Hungary and then later on to Germany. But, of course, I'm concerned about being on the airplane with a lot of people. And I was wondering if there would there be any extra advice for me to keep myself safe. I was thinking about wearing protective gloves, you know, like surgical gloves. Would you think that that's something that I could do? And of course, wiping the tray and the seat and all that. But
good question.
Just,
if you do have to travel, what would you
do?
Great question. Thanks, Jilla. What do you say? If you do have to travel, now what do we do?
So the first thing is when you are traveling, look at the latest travel alerts from the U.S. CDC, from the World Health Organization, and the countries that you're in from their national advisories. The airflow on modern planes is excellent, and their filters are good, but you're doing exactly the right thing in terms of keeping the surfaces clean and being vigilant in about that. Face masks, the face masks aren't generally recommended for just everyday use, because the spread is often from hand to face, and to wear a face mask properly and to get one that really protects you doesn't work out. So what you're doing with the surfaces is the most important thing. Keeping that clean, regular hand washing, and being really vigilant about that.
Priscilla, we are talking about this now because it is in the headlines. It will drop from the headlines. We will stop talking about it. And I know in your book you talk about some of these underlying health inadequacies, particularly in our system, that make us vulnerable. Tell us more about that.
Absolutely. I'm a fanatic about getting the word out about a 1978 conference at Alma-Ata, which is in the former Soviet Union. And there, 134 nations and about half again as many NGOs got together and made the commitment, first, to believe that health is a fundamental human right, and secondly, to work for universal access to primary health care by the year 2000. And of course, we're very far from these goals. Now, why is that relevant to this question? It's relevant because the biggest single vector that turns an outbreak into a pandemic is global poverty. And we hear something like that and we think, well, that's too big to handle. So I'm going to quote Jono's wonderful book and say, let's imagine the impossible, then make it happen. How do we do that? We don't imagine dealing with global poverty as something that's impossible. We make the commitment to understand that health is a basic human right, and that for humanitarian reasons, we really want to create a healthcare situation where this kind of pandemic can be stopped in its tracks in the first place. And that involves adequate food, adequate shelter, adequate clothing, and adequate healthcare. And I don't think these things are beyond reach. And in fact, I think they're economically sensible. The World Bank and the World Health Organization has shown that it is much more economical as well as humanitarian to be prepared rather than to deal with the crisis when it happens.
Can I follow on that with a lesson from the 1918 flu? Among 400 cities in the U.S., we had a fourfold difference in the flu-related mortality. Half of that difference was explained by poverty, health care, and air pollution. So this isn't theory. This is a reality. And these factors do have a huge impact on our health.
I want to thank both of you.
I would just add one thing very quickly, that it's our development and the way that we're globalizing that is putting us in contact with these new microbes in the first place. So I want to really second what Jono said and recommend his wonderful book.
Yeah, well, it's generating a lot of wealth, and it could also generate health. Why we'd have the whole package. Priscilla Wald, author of Contagious, Cultures, Carriers, and the Outbreak Narrative, also a professor of English at Duke. Jonathan Quick, a professor of global health at Duke University, former director of essential drugs and medicines policy at the World Health Organization. Of course, we've got links to healthcare organizations where you can find more information at our website, stateofthings.org. All the links are there. If you want accurate information about what you should do, go to our website, stateofthings.org.